From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Michael Callan is one of the longest surviving people with AIDS. He's also one of the people who's logged the most time as an AIDS activist. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss surviving with AIDS and creating an alternative to the medical establishment's AIDS drug testing program. Also today, we meet award-winning novelist James Welch. Welch's fiction explores the past and the fractured present of the American Indian. World music critic Milo Miles plays the music of Senegal's top star, singer Youssou N'Dour. And Owen Gleiberman reviews Rocky V. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush departed this evening on the first leg of a 7-day trip to Europe and the Middle East, his first stop, Czechoslovakia. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports from Prague.
President Bush is scheduled to meet with President Václav Havel and separate delegations of Czech and Slovak leaders Saturday. By mid-afternoon, he'll appear in Wenceslas Square to address a throng of several hundred thousand people celebrating the first anniversary of the Velvet Revolution, which marked the end of communist rule here in Czechoslovakia. Come Sunday, President and Mrs. Bush will push on to Germany for a brief meeting with Chancellor Helmut Kohl, and then on to Paris for the summit of the 34-nation Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. This part of the trip, especially here in Prague, gives Mr. Bush the opportunity to hail the triumph of democracy and the end of the Cold War. Come Wednesday, President Bush will be in Saudi Arabia to prepare to spend Thanksgiving Day with the U.S. troops there. He will be joined by Senate leaders George Mitchell and Bob Dole, as well as House leaders Tom Foley and Bob Michael. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Canada's defense minister said today that his nation will ask the United Nations Security Council to endorse the use of force against Iraq. The minister, Bill McKnight, was in the Gulf nation of Bahrain as part of a tour of the region. McKnight said the Canadian government doesn't believe that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein can be persuaded to leave Kuwait by peaceful means. Earlier this week, McKnight inspected Canadian troops in Saudi Arabia. Germany's foreign minister has appealed to Western nations to help the Soviet Union with its current economic crisis. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Hans-Dietrich Genscher said a joint action by the West is necessary to help preserve stability in the Soviet Union. The foreign minister said an immediate plan should be drawn up in Paris next week during the major security conference that will be held there. In an interview on West German television tonight, Genscher said that immediate money and economic assistance from Western nations are crucial. The stability of the Soviet Union is our stability, Genscher underlined. Yesterday, German Chancellor Helmut Kohl announced that Bonn would continue food aid to the Soviet Union began last year. Nationwide television funding appeals were broadcast in Germany today to finance emergency food and supplies for Russia. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
The chief counsel for the Senate Ethics Committee charged today that Senator Alan Cranston actively solicited contributions from savings and loan owner Charles Keating at times when Keating wanted help with federal banking regulators. Cranston went before the committee today to deny that there was any link between the contributions and his meetings with federal regulators. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at 2,550.25. Advances edged declines in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Michael Callan is one of the people with AIDS who has survived the longest. He was diagnosed in 1982. According to the best estimate, he says, only 25 of the over 1,000 Americans diagnosed that year are still alive. His new book, Surviving AIDS, tells his story along with the stories of 13 other long-term survivors. The summer he found out he was sick, he decided to do something he'd wanted to do for a long time, organize a band. Callan is a singer who now performs with the a cappella group The Flirtations. He's also an AIDS activist. He co-founded the People with AIDS Coalition, perhaps the first group in the AIDS self-empowerment movement. And he co-founded the Community Research Initiative, which conducts scientific research on promising AIDS therapies in a community-based setting which is intended to yield faster results than the medical establishment has. Michael Callan told me he was diagnosed before the disease was even called AIDS, when it was known as gay-related immune deficiency, or GRID.
Well, actually, I had the symptoms of what everyone came to know was AIDS for at least a year before I got my official diagnosis, which was in the summer of 1982. I knew I was sick for some time, and when I first heard about or read reports of this new mysterious sexually transmitted disease, there was never any question in my mind that I was going to get it. I matched the profile of the early cases of AIDS. I had a long, distinguished track record of sexually transmitted diseases, many sexual partners, and so it was not a surprise to me when the doctor came in the summer of 82 and said, well, it's GRID, which then became AIDS.
What did he tell you in terms of the prognosis?
Well, actually, it was a she, and she didn't really talk about, you know, prognosis. Actually, I'm very lucky. None of my doctors have ever, like, looked me in the eye and said, you have 6 months to live. The doctor who diagnosed my first opportunistic infection said it was a disease. I had cryptosporidium, which is an intestinal parasite infection, and she said, we didn't think that humans could get this. It was a disease of cattle.
That's encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah.
Makes you feel good.
Took me a while to take that in, and she said, all she said was, you'll either handle it or you won't. And that was as close as she came to saying, you know, you might be dead in a week or 6 months. AIDS in the early days was often very rapidly fatal. There's some speculation now that it might even have been a different disease or more virulent in the early days. Certainly people got very sick, multiple opportunistic complications, and tended to die very quickly. And I was vaguely aware of that. There wasn't really a network of people with AIDS who got together and talked. So you sort of picked it up through the grapevine, that this was a really devastating disease that could carry you off very quickly. But I was very lucky. When I was diagnosed in late 82, I joined the first support group for people with AIDS ever formed in New York City. And as fate would have it, I met one of the longest surviving people with AIDS in medical literature. At the time I met him in 82, he had been retrospectively diagnosed with Kaposi's sarcoma and therefore AIDS back to 1978. So he had already had AIDS for 4 years. He was witty, vivacious, had a business, traveled the world. Just knowing that someone else had been there seemed to make it easier to enter the long-term survivor sweepstakes.
How has your health been since 1982 when you were diagnosed?
Well, it's one of the many paradoxes of AIDS that I've been healthier since getting AIDS than I was in the years before I got AIDS. I mean, by that I mean, relatively speaking, I have virtually no immune system and have not had any, I have never had above 200 T4 cells since I was first tested in 1981. But paradoxically, I've had fewer colds, fewer flus, no sexually transmitted disease. All the rashes and drips and rashes and, you know, fevers and all that stuff that were so much just you took it in stride when you were part of the sexual revolution of the 70s and early 80s. All that evaporated because I started practicing safer sex. And I'm hospitalized at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. My main problem, I now have Kaposi's sarcoma. I've managed to peaceably coexist with cryptosporidium. My main problem is bacterial pneumonia, which I get right on cue every year. But it's fortunately not pneumocystis pneumonia, which is the very serious pneumonia that affects people with AIDS and that is responsible for most AIDS deaths. So I'm lucky. I'm functional. I lead what I consider a super normal life. I'm more productive than I've ever been at any point in my life, and I'm happier than I've ever been at any point in my life. Of course, I wish I didn't have AIDS, and I wish I could put this all behind me, but this is the hand that life has dealt me, and I intend to play it and however long I have on this earth.
Michael Callan is my guest, and he has AIDS, and he's one of the people who survived the longest with AIDS. He's written a new book called Surviving AIDS. He's also an AIDS activist. We'll be talking about some of his work as an activist in a couple of minutes. Probably a lot of people want to know, what drugs have you been taking that have helped you survive this long? And the truth is that the most frequently used AIDS drug, you haven't taken at all. You've never taken AZT.
I have never taken a single AZT pill, and one of the things that surprised me, although pleasantly this time, was that very, very few of the long-term survivors I interviewed have ever touched AZT. I have in my book a whole chapter devoted to the case against AZT. I happen to believe that AZT is chemical genocide. It's fraud from start to finish. I say in the book, and I firmly believe, that a person who is immunologically impaired or who has AIDS has to decide whether they want to try to be a survivor of AIDS or try to be a survivor of AZT, because I don't believe that you can do both. AZT was a drug that was invented in the 60s as a potential therapy for cancer, and it was abandoned as unfit for human use because it interrupts DNA synthesis wherever it finds it. In other words, it does not differentiate between infected or malnormal or... It just kills cells wherever it finds them. The one thing that everybody agrees about AZT is that it suppresses the bone marrow. The bone marrow is the only source that a person with AIDS has for generating the cells that she or he needs to survive. How taking a drug that kills the very source of the cells you need can, as a long-term strategy, benefit anyone is beyond me. And there is now a growing awareness that AZT isn't turning out to be everything that we've been sold. It's in addition to being the most expensive drug in the history of the pharmaceutical industry and to have been approved by the FDA on the basis of fraudulent research, which has been amply documented before. And there's a new book that actually goes behind the scenes and talks about the scandalous pharmaceutical intrigue that led to the approval of AZT. The fact is, almost none of the long-term survivors took AZT. There is ample evidence which argues against it, and I would encourage anyone in your listening audience who is making that painful, difficult choice about whether to take AZT or not to do their homework, seek out all sorts of different opinions, talk to people who've taken it who like it, talk to people who've taken it who had to go off of it, talk to people who decided never to go on it, and then go off in the woods by yourself and sort it all out and make your own decision. But whatever you do, don't take AZT just because your doctor tells you to.
I should mention here that there are AIDS activist groups who endorse the use of AZT, that your opinion is perhaps in a minority.
Yes, absolutely. A growing minority, I'm pleased to say, mm-hmm. but definitely a minority.
Have you ever had second thoughts? Did you ever feel like, you know, maybe I really ought to be taking it? It's a very hard decision to decide whether to take a drug or not. Of course, your doctor didn't recommend it, so it wasn't as hard as it would be for someone whose doctor did recommend it.
Well, I have to say that I've taken a number of controversial political positions in my career as an AIDS activist. None has subjected me to the brutality from the government and within my own community as my position about AZT. I am as convinced as I am of anything in this world that AZT is killing people. And it's not something that I like to say. It's not easy to say, because often when I address a group of people with AIDS, the overwhelming majority of people are on it. And I've done my homework. And the way I present the case against AZT in the book and when I speak publicly, there is ample evidence, theoretical and published evidence in the medical literature, against the use of AZT that concludes that it does not extend life, that it causes cancer. And most people making that momentous decision are not aware that this literature exists. They're led to believe that only a few crazy people like me oppose it for reasons that are not entirely rational. And I say it in the book, and I would say it to your listeners, the decision of whether or not to take AZT is probably the most momentous decision that a person with AIDS makes, and it is not a decision to be made lightly. And if you're going to do your homework about any particular aspect of AIDS, that's where I would recommend people start.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. Michael Callan is my guest, and he was diagnosed as having AIDS in 1982, and he's one of the people who have survived the longest with this disease. And his new book is about other men and women who've had the disease a long time. It's called Surviving AIDS. He's also an AIDS activist and a singer and songwriter, and we'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Callan is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Surviving AIDS. He also co-founded People with AIDS Coalition and the Community Research Initiative. You're a co-founder of the Community Research Initiative, which is, well, let me ask you to describe what the function of this group is.
Well, the Community Research Initiative is now an entire movement. There are over 45 CRIs around the country. When we founded it in 1987, it was a measure of our intense frustration with the failure of the federal AIDS treatment research effort to find anything of value for people with AIDS. I'm fond of saying that the AIDS treatment research bureaucracy will turn out to be the HUD of the 90s. Billions have been spent, nothing has been produced, and there's been no accountability. Those of us living with AIDS were so frustrated that we came up with an idea radical in its simplicity. Here in America, drug treatment research has been entirely controlled by academic medical centers and by the pharmaceutical industry. But we people with AIDS felt that our physicians, our community physicians who were actually keeping us alive on a day-to-day basis, who had the hands-on experience and who had our interests at heart, should group together with people with AIDS themselves and other research experts to design our own clinical trials. And that's exactly what we did. And strangely enough, what we discovered was that the pharmaceutical industry was itself quite frustrated with how cumbersome and inefficient the federal AIDS treatment bureaucracy was. And though in the first 2 years they kept their distance but kept meeting with us and were very interested and occasionally would give us money, after the community research groups in San Francisco and New York actually completed a clinical trial of aerosol pentamidine for the prevention of the number one killer of people with AIDS, pneumocystis pneumonia. After that research led to FDA approval of aerosol pentamidine, we were besieged by pharmaceutical companies eager to conduct their trials in our community-based setting. The advantage or the major difference between the community-based research movement and the way drugs are tested here in America in other diseases is that we believed that if people with AIDS have a say in designing the protocols, in saying what risks they're willing to take and what risks they're not willing to take, that we will have better enrollment and better compliance with the protocols, which will mean that the value, the scientific value of data generated by community-based research, we believe is of a higher quality than government AIDS research, which is often viewed by people with AIDS as punitive.
Well, yeah, you say that the federally designed clinical trials are often unethical and poorly designed, and that community-based research is trying to design trials and research groups that are more sensitive to people with AIDS. Can you compare?
Yeah, well, one quick example that will illustrate the point. A number of the early federal trials forbid people from taking any medication to prevent pneumocystis pneumonia, which was the number one killer of people with AIDS, even though it had become the unofficial community standard for anyone with 200 or fewer T cells to be put on some form of medication to prevent pneumonia. And the reason that the government forbid the use of preventive therapies was because they wanted to use death as a measure of the effectiveness of a drug. If people in the trial died, then you would know, if people getting the drug didn't die and people not getting the drug died, then you would attribute the benefit to the drug. We felt that was really unethical, and that people who died, for example, of pneumocystis in the AZT trial or in some of the early trials, didn't have to die. And that is not a risk that the community-based research movement would ever ask subjects to take. It's unnecessary. There are other equally scientifically valid ways of designing trials that will give you credible scientific information. And, I mean, unfortunately, AIDS treatment research is littered with atrocities that were unnecessary and ultimately counterproductive, because what happened is that people entering government trials cheated, and the value of the data is pretty useless.
Do you think that the National Institute of Health is using more of an academic model of, focusing on accuracy but taking the kind of slow route to that accuracy, as opposed to taking the route that would get the information and the drugs out the soonest to the people who have AIDS?
Well, I have to state it this strongly. I think that we've been given the third string of scientists, not the first string and not the second string. I would flush the entire lot of them, admit defeat, start anew, new personnel, try to find ways to attract the top scientists, not just in the country but in the world, send the message loud and clear that we really want to solve the AIDS problem and that we're willing to put the resources behind it necessary to do that. I mean, we've spent 8 years of federally financed AIDS research, and we are nowhere.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you think that the second string,
third
string scientists are working on AIDS. It seems like it's such a huge problem that I would think that the best scientists would be eager to work on AIDS-related research.
Well, there are two problems. One is that in the early days, the best scientists weren't attracted to it because of the stigma associated with the disease. The groups that got AIDS, I mean, you'd have to deal with homosexuals and drug users and people of color, and it just wasn't, believe it or not, in the early years of the epidemic, it was not a sexy career choice. And then the problem now, even though there's a lot of money, government money flowing, what happened is that we call it the AIDS mafia. There's a group of incompetent, arrogant people that totally control AIDS research. They review each other's papers, and it's an old boy network that is just impenetrable. So a young scientist or a really qualified scientist who would like to come with fresh ideas about AIDS, how to approach treatment that isn't entirely antiretroviral, would never be admitted into this fraternity of AIDS researchers that have so bungled AIDS research so far, spent billions, and are complicit in the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans.
What kinds of results are coming out of community research now?
Well, primarily community research has announced that it will concentrate on opportunistic infections, prevention, treatment, and control. Many of them are also looking for investigating immune modulators, things that might improve immune function, and some are also testing antiretrovirals. But generally, the government is almost exclusively testing antiretroviral therapies, and the community research movement is investigating the other two areas which have not been much investigated by the government, which is opportunistic infection research and immune modulation.
So is community research testing drugs that haven't been approved yet by the FDA? And if so, how do you get access to them?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the pharmaceutical companies have a whole storehouse full of drugs that they would love to test. And FDA approval isn't required in most instances to... Well, it's a whole complicated thing. It has to pass certain safety requirements and animal tests. But there are many, many drugs that have passed that, which for whatever reason the government isn't interested in testing in the context of AIDS. The community research movement is quite interested in testing.
Would you be willing to be in one of those studies yourself, to be a guinea pig for an untested drug?
You mean a community-based research protocol?
Yeah,
I have been. I am, yes. I actually believe that many people with AIDS are willing to take greater risks than some people might imagine for the greater good of the greater number of people, provided that there's reason to believe that there will be a payoff for that risk, if not for themselves, for others, that the data generated by the trial will be scientifically credible and that the FDA will be able to rely on it. But what has happened in the case of government research is that people take risks, they suffer, the data is presented, and the FDA rejects it because it's so sloppy.
Do you like to research a drug before participating in a study of it?
Absolutely.
So that you know what it is you're ingesting.
I would never, ever, ever take a drug unless I knew everything that is currently known about the drug. Theoretical use in humans, animal experiments. There's a process called informed consent, and it's the community-based research movement takes that process very seriously and ensures that people considering entering one of its trials know everything there is to know in simple, understandable language about what they're being asked to take or do.
Do you participate in double-blind studies? Do you know if you're getting the drug or a placebo when you participate in community research?
Generally speaking, the community research movement has stated that it wishes to avoid placebo double-blind trials wherever possible. There are instances in which that is the best, safest, cleanest way to get an answer. If it's a drug that just has not been used in any other disease or in humans, a quick and dirty placebo double-blind trial might be the fastest way. But generally speaking, the overwhelming majority of community-based clinical trial designs do not include a placebo.
Have you decided recently to resign from some of your activist groups in order to take care of your own health?
Yes. I, in fact, have just moved from New York to Los Angeles from New York, and I have resigned from each of the organizations that I talk about in my book. I've done two tours of duty. It's time for the next generation, and it's time for me to start taking my own advice. And my life, AIDS activism is quite brutal. People, you know, it's a life and death struggle, and people hold their opinions passionately, and there are many enemies and lots of suffering, and I'm a musician, and I'd like to have a life beyond AIDS, and I feel that I've done my bit. I've spoken and written, and anybody who is interested in what Michael Callan thinks about any aspect of AIDS with just the slightest effort can find it in a library or by calling the People with AIDS Coalition, and it isn't necessary for me anymore to be traveling 180,000 air miles from one end of the earth to the other preaching the same gospel.
Michael Callan, thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you good health.
Thank you.
My guest has been singer-songwriter and AIDS activist Michael Callan. His new book is called Surviving AIDS. Next time, political journalist Gary Wills, his new collection of essays, Under God, looks at the role of religion in American politics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Let's listen to Michael Callan sing. This is from his album, Purple Heart.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Youssou N'Dour of Senegal is often named as the first African musician with a shot at becoming an international superstar. Coming up, world music critic Milo Miles gives his thoughts on N'Dour and his music. Also, James Welch discusses his new novel, The Indian Lawyer, and tells us about his childhood growing up on a reservation. And Owen Gleiberman reviews Rocky V. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is now on his way to Europe, where his first stop is Czechoslovakia. Mr. Bush will be the first American president to visit Prague. From there, he moves on to Germany and talks with German Chancellor Kohl, and then Paris and a 34-nation conference on security and cooperation in Europe. After the Paris meeting, the president will travel to Saudi Arabia, where he will be joined by the congressional leadership on Thanksgiving. A UN Security Council debate on Israel's treatment of the Palestinians in the occupied territories is drawing to a close. The PLO supporters on the council have proposed a new resolution. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
Diplomatic sources say the PLO is trying to force an American veto of a resolution that would convert a UN military team to a monitoring agency for human rights in the occupied territories. The United Nations Truce Supervision Organization enforces a 1948 armistice between Israel and Jordan and would require Israeli approval for a change in mandate to carry out any new function. Western Council members hope a compromise can be reached that would only call for the convening of the 164 countries who signed the Geneva Convention on the Treatment of Civilians Living Under Occupation. Although Israel opposes both measures, officials hint the United States might agree to support the compromise. A vote is expected as early as Monday. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
In Washington, the Federal Reserve has taken action to nudge interest rates lower amid further signs that the economy has entered a downturn. This is the second adjustment the Fed has made in less than 1 month. NPR's John Edstey reports.
The central bank moved the important federal funds rate about 0.8% lower by pumping cash into the banking system today. That lowers the cost of money for banks and should translate into lower interest rates for consumer and business loans. Many economists have been urging the Fed to move aggressively to lower interest rates in order to stimulate borrowing and boost the faltering economy. The Fed has kept interest rates high to choke off inflation. But today, the government reported a slowdown of inflation. That gave the central bank some wiggle room. The Fed may also have been motivated by recent reports of fewer jobs and lower factory utilization in October, which convinced many experts that the U.S. economy began to shrink last month. Today, the Commerce Department issued September trade figures. They showed a drop in imports, a sign that U.S. consumers are spending less, and further evidence of economic weakness. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 5 points to close at 2,550.25 on volume of some 166 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, Owen Gleiberman reviews Rocky V. World music commentator Milo Miles has been contemplating the start and stop rise of African singer Youssou N'Dour. Milo wonders if conscientious, good hard work and abundant talent are enough to make this singer and his band, Super Étoile de Dakar, internationally famous. Milo says that N'Dour is almost a star, but still needs an elusive dash of luck and genius to put him over the top.
Youssou N'Dour is a respected member of the Wolof tribe, which dominates his native country of Senegal. And since the late 70s, he's been a prime performer of the Senegalese pop music called Mbalax that's now heard all over Africa. So Ndor is used to success, and everything about his manner and his work radiates confidence. But I've always found pronouncements that Ndor was destined to be Africa's first truly international superstar to be very glib and a too obvious prediction. Ndor stands exactly where all the proper stardom lines intersect. He's personable, has a strong, penetrating voice. He's well-connected, a pal of Peter Gabriel, among others. And most important, he consciously wants to fuse Senegalese folk music with Western rock and disco. Trouble is, pop stardom usually doesn't strike just where everybody expects it. Nobody really forecast a Beatles, a Bob Dylan, and a Bob Marley before they arrived. This is not to say that Ndor has not grown more potent as he has developed his combination of charisma and dedication to communication. This next tune is an up-tempo track from his first American album in 1985. Back then, he had a simple-minded approach to U.S. dance music and was apparently convinced audiences here couldn't take too many polyrhythms. If you compare that with a similar kind of cut from Ndor's latest collection, it's plain that he has become not merely more intricate and more unashamedly African, but more himself. Still, for all the nimble poise of Ndor and his 10-piece band, I find their numbers often stop just short of compelling, which may not be their fault, but in the nature of his Mbalax music itself. This is essentially a percussion music with various instruments from guitar to saxophone to synthesizers layered on top, but rarely taking solos. The drum solo, indeed one of the foundations of Mbalax, is the prominent role of the small talking drum called the tama. Purely percussive African music, however, no matter how dense and spirited, always sounds folkloric to me, and Mbalax does not entirely escape from this. But hey, lots of people just love the folk wholesome side of African pop, and Ndor's got it for certain. Ndor has a couple other fine arrows in his sling. He's an understated, humane, social and moral crusader in his songs. Big on self-respect and third-world industriousness, down on toxic chemicals and religious intolerance. But his biggest advantage may be that without forcing the issue, he's one of the most non-sexist performers in pop. His musician mother was a profound influence on him, and that helps explain why he advocates respect for moms and daughters and refuses to blame women for failed romances. Ndor's love stories contain sadness, but there's no room for revenge, and such calm compassion is rare in performers from anywhere. The latest Ndor record is called Set, and his band has never sounded sharper and more adroit. But I would suggest neophytes start with the album just before this one, called The Lion, where the variety and flow of Ndor's songwriting hits a peak. He's a clever guy, no question. Who else could make a song about museums as poignant and catchy as Endor?
I have visited many fine museums in my time. The one closest to me and the saddest is a house of slaves on the island of Gora, where so many of my people were held before being forced to leave Africa forever. How will I find all these days in my life? Why don't we try now? How will I find all these days in my life? Why don't you try now?
Yuzu Endor's albums, The Lion and Set, are on the Virgin record label. Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is Fresh Air. James Welch writes contemporary and historical fiction about Native Americans. His novel Fool's Crow won an American Book Award. Welch grew up on the Blackfeet and Fort Belknap reservations in Montana. For 10 years, he served on the Montana State Board of Parole. It's a position he gave his main character in the new novel The Indian Lawyer. The story is about Sylvester Yellowcalf, who works in a prominent, mostly white law firm. He's thinking of running for Congress, but one of the convicts he's turned down for parole wants vengeance and blackmails the lawyer. This is Welch's first novel about a Native American who has tried to assimilate into the white professional class.
This is the first time I've dealt with an Indian who really was a success by anybody's terms. He was a good student, an excellent basketball player. He went to Stanford Law School. He's in a prestigious firm in Helena. He's on a parole board, and he just seems to have it made. And I did want to write about a character who did make it in the world of the dominant society and see what kind of pressures that might put on this person, how that this person would adjust.
Do you feel that you've been exposed to those pressures yourself?
Not really. I think writing is a little different from lawyering. Being a lawyer, you're in contact with a lot of different people, and I think there's a kind of innate pressure there. Whereas writing, it's basically a solitary act, and it just doesn't present those same kinds of pressures. I never felt any pressure.
How close do you feel that you've stayed to Indian culture in your life?
In my personal life, I haven't stayed very close at all. I get back up to the two reservations that I'm from a couple of times a year, and I try to go to a ceremony every now and then, a powwow or whatever. But I live in Missoula. It's off the reservation, and I just don't have much contact with reservation life anymore.
But you have a lot of contact with Indian tradition through your writing.
Yes, I've certainly kept up with things and put it in my writing. Some of those old traditions and stories and so on really stick with a person, and so I didn't have to really do a lot of research to call up a lot of the traditional stories.
Well, the story in one of your books, Fool's Crow, is actually based on your grandmother's story of surviving a massacre.
Yes, her name was Red Paint Woman, and when my dad was young, she was still alive. She was my great-grandmother, his grandmother, and she told him a lot of stories about those days, including the story of the Massacre on the Marias, or the Baker Massacre, it's known by both names. And she had been in it, and she and a group of other people managed to escape down to the river and got under a cut bank, and then they went upstream until they were away from the battle. But during the course of that, she did get wounded in the leg, and so I used that incident. My main character, Fool's Crow, comes upon this small band of people, including this woman who's been wounded in the leg. So I did use quite a bit of her stories in writing my own.
What was the importance of this story in your family?
Well, as a matter of fact, my dad wasn't very talkative during his younger years when I was growing up. And so it was probably only 10 years ago that I learned this story, and I learned several other stories. I made a point of having him tell me all of the stories that he knew. And once he got to talking, I think he was really glad to be passing them on to me, because he knew that I would use the stories in a, I guess you'd say, a dignified way in a novel.
Did you find it remarkable that he had never told it to you?
Yes, I did. I learned a lot of things from him, which I had no idea. And I think this is true of a lot of people. Older people start telling stories once they get a little older that I think they didn't think were extremely important to them when they were younger. So I think my dad probably chose a time to tell me these stories. But I do think it was remarkable that he kept them to himself all those years.
Which reservation did you grow up on?
On both the Blackfeet Reservation and the Fort Belknap Reservation. They're both in northern Montana.
Can you tell us a little bit about what life was like there?
Well, it was a good life. I enjoyed growing up. I know a lot of people think, and it's true, that life on reservations is quite dismal, that there's a lot of poverty, a lot of drinking. There's a high incidence of suicide on reservations. And so the problems really are many and serious. But when you're growing up, I think you don't really realize that these problems exist. We're busy playing games, going hunting, and fishing, and just doing things that kids do. It was great country. It's right on the edge of Glacier Park. They share a boundary. And so the landscape is just beautiful. And to us kids growing up, it was an ideal place.
Did you go to Bureau of Indian Affairs schools?
No, two public schools. Both reservations had public schools.
Mm. How was the education on the reservation?
Well, I think it's pretty much like it is in most rural areas where the population is quite small. I did learn a lot. I think the teachers cared. There were always problems among school board members. For instance, most school boards are apportioned so that they usually have a majority of white members. And the white members control the curriculum and so on. So when I was growing up, there weren't any courses in Indian culture. It was all straight dominant culture stuff. And we learned the history of Indians through history books that didn't treat them very fairly, I think. This was a long time ago, and I hope things are better now. But back then, I know that Indians were portrayed as savages who pretty much had to be swept out of the way in order for the West to be settled. And that was the thrust of education at that time.
Did those kinds of textbooks and did Western movies affect your self-image at all?
Somewhat. I know that at the movie house in Browning when I was a kid, and we used to go to, on the reservation, go to movies, I remember this very distinctly, that the cavalry would be fighting the Apaches, Geronimo or whatever. And as soon as the cavalry came into view, came to make their charge, the people in the audience would cheer and applaud, and they were mostly Indians. So it was really amazing. But at the time, it didn't seem amazing. It only seems that way in retrospect.
You always know who the hero of the movie is, and you identify even.
That's right. Yeah. I think people wanted to be Errol Flynn.
Yeah. How did you start writing?
I used to write in high school, but it was mostly the mushy cheerleader poems or the stately trees and wheeling gulls type of poems. They were pretty lousy. But it wasn't until I got into graduate school in the creative writing program at the University of Montana that I met a poet named Richard Hugo. He made it seem that anybody could write poetry, that you didn't have to be extremely bright, you didn't have to look a certain way, you didn't have to be tall and gaunt and wear a cape or whatever. So he encouraged me and my fellow students, who were mostly from small towns in Montana, to write. And so I did. And after that, I just became obsessed with writing. I was writing a poem a day for a year, and it gradually slacked off. But I just felt that it was something that I could really do, and I loved it.
Why do you think your writing stayed on the reservation long after you had left it?
Well, again, it was Dick Hugo who opened my eyes. I always felt that nobody would be interested in northern Montana, in, you know, such an unpopulated area, and in Indian people, in reservations. I just thought that people were interested in other things, things that went on in cities, cowboys rather than Indians. And so when I first started writing poems, I was writing about all different kinds of things. And Dick said, well, what about your own background? What about the reservation? What about northern Montana? I said, nobody's interested. And he said, well, try it. And once I started, I just couldn't stop. I realized even if it wasn't interesting to other people, it was extremely interesting to me to explore through my writing. And as it turned out, it is interesting to other people, too.
Well, James Welch, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Terry.
James Welch's new novel is called The Indian Lawyer. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's joining us from Washington, D.C. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, some first anniversaries observed on today's program. A year after the killings of Jesuit priests in San Salvador, we'll be hearing what's happened with the case against the Salvadoran soldiers who were accused of that killing. Many say the truth has not yet been made public in El Salvador. Also, a year after the Velvet Revolution began in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, we'll hear students who remember what happened in the great demonstration in the capital city that led to the overthrow of the communist regime. And we'll also talk with a couple of folks about what's been happening in the year ever since in Czechoslovakia.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rocky Balboa has survived more physical abuse in Sylvester Stallone's new movie, Rocky V. Let's see how film critic Owen Gleiberman held up.
The Rocky movies lost their innocence a long time ago. In fact, they lost it the moment Sylvester Stallone took over the director's chores. In no time, he transformed the Rocky saga into a series of high-powered fascist crowd-pleasers. Now, in Rocky V, Stallone makes an honorable stab at recapturing the innocence of this mega-hit series. He's handed the directorial reins back over to John Avildsen, who whose straightforward touch helped give the first Rocky its gritty, Frank Capra on the waterfront charm. As Rocky V opens, our hero has learned that years of getting pummeled by human wrecking machines have left him with permanent brain damage. What's more, his entire fortune has been lost by a sleazy accountant. With nowhere to go, Rocky digs through the attic, finds his old fingerless gloves, leather coat, and pork pie hat, and moves his family back to the one place he knows will always be home, the row houses of South Philly. Since he can't box anymore, Rocky becomes a trainer and takes a gifted young fighter named Tommy Gunn under his wing. Tommy becomes a surrogate for Rocky, winning fight after fight. But it's not long before he comes under the spell of George Washington Duke, a Don King-like Faustian promoter who desperately wants Tommy to challenge Rocky to a title bout.
Got to challenge that man to fight Tommy Gunn. And if he refuses, then you got to insult him. You got to dog him. You got to humiliate him. You got to do whatever you got to do to get him into that ring. But that's what you got to do.
For a while, the movie looks like it's going to be about whether Rocky will risk his mental health to get back into the ring. But then there's all this family stuff. Rocky Jr., played by Stallone's 14-year-old son, Sage, is jealous of the attention his father has been lavishing on the new fighter. Can Rocky prove he's a loving dad after all?
You know, I thought we were supposed to be late, you know, be very close. Hey, come on, kid, I love you.
No, you don't.
Sure I do, you know. Do you remember what the deal was? We were supposed to be, like, tight, like cross fingers.
No, what you want is you and Tommy be tight. That's you really talking about.
Oh, like, don't say that.
Why can't I say it? Since he's been here, it's Tommy this, Tommy that. You don't have no time for nobody, so I got no time for you.
What are you saying to me, kid? You're like another person.
You're the other person. You said I would be number one to you. You said that and you lied. You lied to me and you lied to Mom.
I never lied to you. Tommy needed my help.
So did I.
Sage Stallone proves a surprisingly talented young actor. But for most of the movie, he and Sly have such an easy rapport, I never really bought Rocky's distance as a father. What's more, Tommy Morrison, the real-life boxing star who plays Tommy Gunn, is a very flat actor. His scenes with Stallone are so underwritten, it's never convincing that Rocky really cares about this guy's career. If Rocky V proves anything, it's that it may simply be too late to inject any real feeling back into this series. The movie uses so many contrivances to turn our hero into an underdog again that it doesn't have a center. It just limps along. Stallone himself is funny and touching as the big-hearted but now slightly blitzed Rocky, whose mind seems every bit as woozy as his words. As a character, Rocky remains appealing to watch, but the magic is definitely gone.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews with production assistance from Roberta Shurak, Joan Tui, and Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Gary Wills examines politics and religion in America. And writer Raymond Andrews tells us about his childhood as one of the last of the Southern sharecroppers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.